This is special programming from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. It's been 14 weeks since the campfire started. Tonight on After Paradise, we bring you the latest on FEMA units, building permits, and debris removal. We also hear about new legislation that could create a statewide network of weather monitoring stations that would help assess the threat of future wildfire in California. And we answer your questions about pets that were displaced after the campfire. Don't forget, you can leave any question you have about campfire recovery on our website, mynspr.org. For Thursday, February 14th, 2019, this is After Paradise. First, as usual, lots of news this week. I spoke in the studio with North State Public Radio's Mark Albert to get the latest on FEMA housing units, the Red Cross shelter, and a press conference with state legislators that happened earlier today in Paradise. Mark, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
Earlier this week, the Butte County Board of Supervisors met and you were there. What were the highlights of that meeting?
Well, the officials are really trying to find a middle ground, a way that they can accommodate people who have been lost their homes and then gotten the sort of double whammy of being told you can't live next to your debris pile. You can't live on your own property until the debris removal process is totally completed. That's left a lot of people in the lurch, those that are visible and also those who've sort of vanished into the willing and welcoming arms of friends, neighbors, and families who maybe are not on a list, but were thinking that this will clear out and in 30 days I'll get to return to my property. And evidently that's not the case. The debris removal 2, which got underway just recently, is expected to last 12 months. Officials at the county level and at the town level have promised that folks who had purchased electrical permits, and these were permits so that you could hook up to utilities while you're staying on your property before the debris removal happens, those people are prioritized and jumping to the top of the list of the properties that will get cleared by Cal OES and Cal Recycle. So they also announced at the Board of Supervisors meeting on Tuesday that they'd made quickly put together a temporary RV park in Oroville where those folks could stay.
What about FEMA housing units?
Obviously, there's been a tremendous amount of impatience in the community about the FEMA housing process. People are not all that aware of what goes into it. FEMA has been negotiating with landlords. That takes time. They can't reveal that because if they reveal a deal, suddenly the price could go up. It makes it difficult for them to negotiate. Additionally, the officials are required to do a flood survey and another risk survey for these sites, and then they have to put in utilities, so sewer lines, electrical wiring, everything that's needed for those sites, and the first units will not be ready before April. The officials were talking about 1,300 people that they need to house or provide housing for. They've identified a number of sites, and they are planning on constructing a site in Gridley that will have 400 units, a site on Hagen Lane with 48, one on Larkin Road in Oroville, another site they're calling the Rosewood site, which is scheduled to break ground tomorrow, as well as more units on the Silver Dollar Fairgrounds in Chico, which will be built out by the Army Corps of Engineers, and I believe that 62 units were discussed there, a total of 620 manufactured housing units at this time.
Speaking of the Silver Dollar Fairgrounds, another story that we've been following is the Red Cross shelter there. Can you tell me what the status is on that shelter currently? Do you know how many people remain there?
Certainly. Officials were saying, and I confirm with this with City Manager Mark Orme today, that there are 9 people still staying there in the dormitory, but that officials hope to have their dormitory closed tomorrow, Friday, and move everyone out and find alternative dwellings for each and every person there. There are also RVs that are still on site that are outside, and those folks are being transitioned to paying for those. There are some 67 people there.
Today, you were in Paradise, and there were many state officials who were speaking there. What's the latest? What was going on there?
Well, that's absolutely correct. The top line, there was a big event at the Pine Ridge School. It's an elementary school in Magalia. We had a number of officials, including Governor Newsom, was at the event. He spoke to school children. Here's some of that.
I left my home.
You did? Well, how long were you living there? All your life? You grew up there. Wow. Mm-hmm. And are you in a trailer now, too?
In a bar.
Is it a trailer or an RV?
It's a trailer.
Yeah. We're living behind a church.
Behind the church?
Mm-hmm.
The reason the governor was there in the first place was that yesterday legislation was signed providing backfilling all of the property tax for the town of Paradise and other sites in the burn area.
We signed legislation yesterday committing something the state of California has never committed to any community, and that's 3 years to offset and backfill 100% of the property tax losses of this community, and also to do the same for our school system. That's not something you should applaud. That's something you should expect. That's not something to celebrate. That's just something we had to do.
Property tax is the fundamental funder for schools. With so much property destroyed, obviously the revenue coming into the county and then going to the school district is going to plummet. The state stepped forward, and whatever they collect, the state was going to fill the hole compared to last year. There were other officials from the school district and from Butte County Schools there. I spoke with a counselor who's attempting to help children through the transition and through this catastrophe. She had some very important points.
The hardest thing for me personally is to listen to the children talk about losing their pets. For many kids, their dogs and cats were their everything. And then there's been secondary loss, because as these families have all doubled up with other families, there have been animals that have had to be given away because maybe grandpa was allergic to cats or somebody didn't like dogs. And so the kids lose everything. They get a new place. They're going to be staying for a while, usually in an RV on somebody's property. And then there's another layer of loss.
And that was Elaine Collins. She's a mental health counselor who's retired, and she's brought back to assist in schools. The other thing that was going on today, we had Assemblyman Brian Dolly, who represents actually parts of Magalia. We had Assemblyman James Gallagher, who represents much of Paradise as well as much of the Valley, and State Senator Jim Nielsen in attendance, along with five other members of the state legislature. They got to tour firsthand the damage and the extent of the devastation, which should prove useful in terms of gaining resources. You know, in government speak, the word resources means money.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow is the deadline to get many important campfire-related applications submitted. This includes registering for the government-sponsored debris removal program. I spoke with Butte County Public Information Officer Casey Hatcher by phone this morning to get an update on signups and learn more about the importance of this impending deadline. The first thing I asked was how many people are currently signed up for the government-sponsored program.
So far, 10,743 right-of-entry forms have been submitted, and that is the form that allows access to the government contractors to do the debris removal.
And you know what percentage that is at this point?
When you combine how many right-of-entry forms have been submitted with the 222 alternative program applications, about 84% of property owners who are required to do debris removal have submitted into one of the two programs.
And I know we've talked about this on past episodes of After Paradise before, but the government-sponsored program is of no cost to property owners, whereas the other debris removal program they can sign up for, I think it's called the alternative program, could have them paying out-of-pocket costs. Can you kind of talk about the differences between those two programs people can sign up for?
The government program has no out-of-pocket costs, which means that the county will work with property owners after the debris removal has happened to seek reimbursement for any insurance proceeds that they have for debris removal. The program's funded by taxpayers, so there can't be a duplication of benefits. So if a property owner receives insurance for the debris removal, then that portion will be collected. If a property owner selects to hire a properly licensed contractor and use the alternative program cleanup standards, they are liable for 100% of those costs, just like you would be with any construction project.
They also have to submit a work plan with that, too, and hire that licensed contractor, correct?
That's correct. So the alternative program is set up to mirror the way that the CalRecycle program works for debris removal. And that's in order to address the health and safety concerns and the widespread properties that are having burn debris on them. And so they submit an application and then the contractor submits a work plan so they can lay out exactly how the debris removal will happen. And that's required for anybody participating in the alternative program.
And then what is the deadline for the alternative program?
The deadline to submit an application for the alternative program is February 28th.
The original deadline for the government-sponsored program was January 31st. That was extended. Is there any chance it will be extended again?
Cal OES extended the deadline to submit right of entry forms. They created a late submission period through February 15th, and that was in response to a lot of information we were hearing from the community that people needed more time to gather paperwork, to make decisions about the program. We haven't heard at this point that there's any intention to extend that late submission period, so we really encourage people to make sure they get their right of entry forms submitted if they want to participate in the government program.
And then how can people sign up for the program?
So they can submit a right of entry form either by going to the right of entry center at 202 Mira Loma in Oroville or at the Disaster Recovery Center in Chico at the Chico Mall. There's environmental health staff there to collect those right of entry forms. And they can do that through tomorrow. They can also mail them in to 202 Mira Loma in Oroville, 95965, and that just has to be postmarked by tomorrow, or they can email them to roe@buttecounty.net.
What happens if people do not sign up for either the government-sponsored program or the alternative program?
Well, it's not optional to leave fire debris on your property. It's a health and safety risk for the community, and it needs to be addressed. So folks need to sign up for one of the two programs. And if they don't, then the town and the county will have to come through and use their code enforcement powers and likely abate those properties. So we really want to make sure that people opt into one of the two programs. They want to hire a contractor and do that cleanup privately or sign up for the government program by submitting the right of entry form. What we don't want to have to do is go through and abate the properties because it can be costly for the property owner if that full amount of the abatement has to be leaned on the property.
That was Butte County Public Information Officer Casey Hatcher. Again, to sign up for the government-sponsored debris removal program, you do need to fill out a right of entry form. You can find that form and more information about the other debris removal option at buttecountyrecovers.org. And two other important deadlines are also looming. Tomorrow is also the application deadline to register for Federal Emergency Management Agency disaster assistance. You can do so in person at the Disaster Recovery Center in Paradise or Chico, online at disasterassistance.gov, or by calling the FEMA helpline at 800-462-7585. That's 800-462-7585. Tomorrow also is the deadline to apply for a low-interest disaster assistance loan from the U.S. Small Business Administration. These loans are for physical damage from the campfire and are available to homeowners, renters, businesses, and nonprofit organizations. Online applications are available at sba.gov/disaster. You can also apply in person at the Chico or Paradise Disaster Recovery Center, or you can call the SBA Customer Service Center at 800-659-2955. Again, that's 800-595-2955. Now moving to your questions. You've been submitting all sorts of questions to us on our website, mynspr.org, and we're working on answering many of them. But last Friday, we noticed a specific question kept coming up. Many of you were wondering about the animals that remain scattered throughout the region, particularly cats. Janet, Angela, and another listener all wrote in to ask how displaced cats are being united with their owners. We teamed up with Capital Public Radio to answer this listener question. Cap Radio's Sammy Caola reports.
Last winter, we teamed up with North State Public Radio to take listener questions about the aftermath of the fire. This month, we got three in a row about the same thing, cats. There are 70 or so feline campfire survivors at the Fieldhaven Recovery Center in Marysville. The nonprofit's volunteers are still trapping cats from the burn zone and bringing them indoors. Some are barn cats or neighborhood cats, but they suspect many had owners. Manager Audra Murphy says they're reluctant to give the cats to new homes because their families might still be out there.
Transferring them out to me feels like we failed to find their people, and that's why we're here, is we want these cats reunited with their people.
The volunteers who reached out to us say Butte County staff has been too quick to give these cats to new families. Animal Control Officer Ryan Soulsby says they held animals for 60 days, that's double the state required 30 days, before moving them to local shelters to be adopted out.
I would much rather have every animal go to its home. At the same time, I have to focus on the health of the animals.
Pets who stay in shelters too long can become sick or anxious. Audra is seeing those symptoms in a lot of the campfire cats. Here she is inspecting a tabby named Amber.
Cats react to stress by getting sick, basically. They get runny eyes, sneezes.
Many cats and dogs are far from their homes. Some shelters are helping these animals find new forever families. Others are posting lost pet photos to social media and hoping for a reunion. Sammy Caola, Cap Radio News.
This story was part of our effort to report on what you need and want to know about campfire recovery. You can submit a question to the station at mynspr.org. There you can also find photos and more information about unclaimed pets. You're listening to After Paradise, a special production from North State Public Radio. More just ahead. This is After Paradise, a special program on the aftermath of the campfire from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Last week, legislation was introduced to establish a statewide network of weather monitoring stations that would help assess the threat of future wildfire in California. It was created by Senator Bill Dodd, a Democrat who represents both Sonoma and Napa counties that were devastated by the North Bay wildfires in 2017. The system would be called the California Wildfire Warning Center, and the hope would be that it would warn officials and the public about dangerous fire weather conditions before a fire starts. KRCB's Adia White spoke to Senator Dodd about his initiative. She started by asking about his reaction to Governor Gavin Newsom's State of the State address earlier this week, which touched on PG&E's bankruptcy and how the state will ensure that the utility upholds its obligations.
This is an issue that's been really dear to you. You've done a lot of work on this. Can you talk about how you feel like we can balance PG&E's bankruptcy and holding them accountable while still making sure that California residents don't bear the brunt of this?
Well, I think that the governor, one of the things that really, again, that blew me away about, you know, his speech today and what I've noticed from him from the very first day, he has been focused on these wildfires. I met in his office a couple weeks ago. It is a high priority. He's got some really smart people, you know, in his, not only in the administration that he's working with, but outside that are helping him. I think we'll see a plan. Well, he said it today, I believe, in 60 days to try to, you know, resolve issues, to protect victims, to make a safe, affordable, reliable grid. And also, you know, affordable means also making sure that ratepayers don't overpay. But let's be clear, ratepayers are going to pay more. And so the ultimate PG&E bailout is what we're going through right now, and this is bankruptcy.
Now I want to move along to talk about your new legislation, the Wildfire Warning Center. Can you just briefly summarize what that legislation would do?
Yes. You know, after the 2017 North Bay fires, I became, you know, quite engaged on a number of different issues with regard to wildfires. Certainly, we have a lot of wildfires in our state that are caused by our utilities, but we also have many that are caused by, you know, human activity, like the car fire was started by a car pulled off the side of the road up near Reading. In the era of utilities, I wanted to find out what all the utilities, not only in the state of California, but in other places in the West, were doing to prevent and have a more resilient grid. And as I traveled the state, I went to San Diego Gas and Electric, and here is a monitoring center that takes in data. They have, you know, literally thousands of weather stations out in their watersheds that measure, you know, temperatures, humidity, winds, and as a result of getting all this data in, they also have visual inspections that give them information where the fuels are really high and where those fuels that are high are near population centers. And so they can take all this data and roll this data into a formula that assesses risk. And so they know and understand at any given time where the highest risk is within their service area. Southern California Gas and Electric is starting to do this. PG&E's started to do this. They're nowhere near where San Diego Gas and Electric. But what we wouldn't be doing is recreating the wheel. What we'd be doing is requiring those entities to give us a feed of all the information that they have, and that we would have the California Public Utilities Commission and CAL FIRE and the California Office of Emergency Services all working together with this California Wildfire Warning Center to be able to take all this data in and have a statewide framework. And so the state understands, you know, where they need perhaps to stage resources, airplanes, tankers, those type of things, and where they should be getting out word to cities and counties, you know, in advance of one of these things, and even, you know, as an extra set of eyes on how do we go about shutting off the grid if that is indeed what's necessary.
So do you feel like this system would need any additional infrastructure? Do you think that we have this infrastructure in place to alert the public? And if so, would the public be able to access these warning systems directly, or would they rely on city and county officials to notify them?
You know, I don't think that has been determined yet. I don't see any reason why that data shouldn't be transparent to anybody that wants to look it up on a website. You know, I think it's too early in the process. That issue will be brought up in the committees, that it will go through first in the Senate and then the Assembly. And so I think that's an opportunity to address that. I think the other thing is none of the communities throughout the state of California have had a satisfactory early warning system or structure that has really helped their constituents, you know, throughout the state in the last 2 or 3 years. And the reality is if we had something like this in 2017, we knew that there were going to be red flag warnings before those fires erupted in October of 2017. But nobody really ever connected that with this is a real fire danger, and it's a fire danger now, and everybody needs to, you know, be able to have a bag packed just in case. Knowledge is power, and having all this information, you know, at the hands of these three state agencies will go a long way in preparation. But I think more importantly, you know, to be able to extinguish the blaze by having assets, again, pre-positioned, so it's a prevention type of, you know, item as well. But there's nothing worse than having, you know, so many people dying because we're not as prepared as we need to be. So I really believe that, you know, going with something like this could have these three agencies maybe opine saying, you got real problems up here in Butte County. We think you should really consider shutting down the power there. And I think as a result of this, and, you know, they shut power off in a number of different places throughout California. I'm talking about PG&E now. And the communities, there was no fires, so the communities were just outraged. Well, I do not think in the future, you know, that is going to be something that's going to be, you know, probably even listened to. We need to be, you know, working perhaps with microgrids for smaller communities so that restaurants and hotels can, you know, continue to work. Certainly, PG&E is already, and all the investor-owned utilities that shut off the grid during these type of times have a responsibility by law, you know, to work with those people that require like oxygen and they have medical devices that absolutely need to have electricity. They are already required to work with them in a different manner. But we're going to have to really relook at how we do things with our electrical power going forward.
So you also mentioned that this bill would allow us time to deactivate power lines should we need to. Do you feel like it would also include a threshold where they would be required to be deactivated? And if so, how would you determine that?
Well, certainly this bill will not, because I don't think that that's something that it's certainly not in the first year, perhaps as data comes in. I think the last thing you want is something that's, now that I'm thinking through the problem, it may very well be that they had decided to shut down up at the campfires, and because of static they got in other areas, you know, the state, they may have backed off. So maybe there is something that needs to be in code. But what we have to do is find the right formula, the right science, you know, that makes some sense. And a lot of that also is PG&E just complying with state law and trimming trees as they're supposed to do by law.
And just more generally speaking, how do you feel like the wildfire warning system would improve our forecasting models? And do you have a clear idea yet of where the data would go and who would be in charge of analyzing that data?
Yeah, it would be three departments, as I said, Cal Fire, Cal OES, Office of Emergency Services, and the California Public Utilities Commission would be responsible for this early wildfire warning system. And what they would do is take in all this information that's already out there from the public utility, investor-owned utilities, and also from University of California has a number of different weather stations in and around. And then anywhere that they needed more information, they would do it. But all these data points can be shared. And so sharing that data in this wildfire center would be able to have them understand, you know, just how big of a threat it is based on fuels, based on wind, based on low humidity, and then also based on population centers and what that risk, you know, what that risk really means.
That was Senator Bill Dodd, who represents California's 3rd District, speaking with KRCB's Adia White. Before we come to the end of the program, a quick update. This Saturday, the hours at both Campfire Disaster Recovery Centers will be changing. In Paradise, the new operating hours will be Monday through Friday from 10 in the morning to 5 in the evening. In Chico, the new hours will be Monday through Friday from 9 in the morning to 6 in the evening. Both locations will be closed on the weekends, and both will be closed this coming Monday in observance of President's Day. And that's our program for Thursday, February 14th, 2019. After Paradise is produced by Mark Albert, Phil Wilkie, and Tess Vigland. Adam Raguzia composed our theme music. Our engineer is Matt Fidler. And don't forget, we do want to hear your questions. You can ask anything you want to know about post-campfire recovery at our website, mynspr.org. Thanks for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, and this is After Paradise from North State Public Radio.